I'm super passionate about parking because the parking requirements stopped, I want to say, at least a third of the projects we were looking at. That's really the thing that feels devastating, that currently 40 people are currently unhoused who could be housed just in the savings on these parking. The hard line I have is if you are somebody who has housing and you are getting in the way of other people's having housing, that to me is the issue. But let's think about the world we want to create, like biking and walking and places for people to thrive. And let's make sure the code is not creating barriers to creating those visions and goals that I know we all have. And I think the parking maximum versus the parking minimum, I think that's where the industry is going. So when I'm talking about trauma-informed design, I am not talking about homeless shelters and just affordable housing. I am talking about schools and grocery stores and parks and how we're building our cities so people can thrive. And I do think it's really important. This isn't an us and them thing. This is an us thing. This is how are we designing buildings for people, right?
We ain't throwing starfish here, now we're having a good party. Talking about structural change. We believe the land is sacred, even beneath that vacant parking lot. But the weeds are doing their best to express the need for something different. Gonna make some space for you and me to live here all together. Gonna make it safe and fun for kids to get around the town. Gonna find me a residential pedestrian district where I can gracefully grow older. Gonna spend my remaining years sharing Boulder.
Hello, Boulder and the wider world. This is the Sharing Boulder podcast. My name is Philip Ogren, and for episode 31, I spoke with Laura Rossbert, who has helped develop a framework called Trauma-Informed Design in her role as ShopWorks Architecture in Denver, Colorado. Laura has collected data that measures the underutilization of parking at affordable housing buildings, and we discussed the negative impacts this has on current and potential affordable housing projects. We also talked about the trauma-informed design framework that ShopWorks Architecture has created and given to the world. I met Laura when she presented at Boulder Housing Advisory Board meeting in May of 2023 and immediately thought, gee, more people should really hear about this. Sadly, it is very difficult to get people to listen to recordings of Housing Advisory Board meetings. Fortunately, she was willing to come on the podcast. We hope you enjoyed this interview with Laura Rossbert.
Hello, Laura. Welcome to Sharing Boulder. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. If you could just, you know, introduce yourself for starters.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be with you. I'm Laura Rossbert. I work at ShopWorks Architecture, where I'm our COO and housing specialist.
That's great. Well, I came to know you because you came to a housing advisory board meeting up in Boulder. And it was such an interesting meeting. You had such great data, but also like this joy and enthusiasm for presenting it. And I was like, oh, more people need to hear about this. So thank you for coming on the podcast. And I think we have a two-part conversation lined up. We're going to talk about some parking and affordable housing data that you collected, and then talk about your framework for building supportive housing and other kinds of affordable housing called trauma-informed design. And I'm super like, my brain is just lit up on both of these subjects. So I wonder if we could just start on the parking data that you collected and tell us about that.
Sure. Yeah. So in my role at ShopWorks, I do a lot of visits to our affordable housing kind of after it's been built. And one of the things I realized about a year into my job at ShopWorks was I was constantly walking through practically empty parking lots. And Of the things I don't like, it's empty parking lots. They're pretty ugly. And in our work in affordable housing, we work to create beautiful, beautiful buildings, and we prefer gardens to, you know, unused concrete. And so I partnered, ShopWorks Architecture partnered with Fox Tuttle. They study transportation and do parking studies to really look at affordable housing across the Front Range and asking, are we building the right amount of parking for these buildings? And what we found, so this research was done in 2019 and 2020, and we studied a number of projects. I think it was 19 in total. And what we found was we were greatly creating much more parking than we needed. And so, for example, as we thought about, hold on, let me just pull up my data. So yeah, we studied 19 properties, 1,300 apartment units, and looked at units ranging from an AMI of 30 to 60%. So that's area median income, right? So that's kind of lower income affordable housing. And what we found is vehicle ownership across all affordable housing was 29% of units. So
are you looking at a slide right now?
I am, yes.
You want to share it?
Okay, sure, yeah. Yes. What we found in our study, as we looked at these 19 apartment buildings, was that, as you can see on this slide, but for those just listening on the podcast, across affordable housing, 29% of units had a car. So one vehicle per four units. We also were looking specifically at supportive housing. So that's housing for folks who are currently unhoused, moving into housing for the first time. And only one unit out of 12 had a car attached. So 8.8%. And as we can imagine, other things impacted the amount of parking utilized. So of course it was, you know, the affordable housing level. It was also, as we thought about how close things were to walking and biking paths and transit services. And I will say these numbers shocked even me. That 8.8% number, I thought that would be close to 30%. And I come to this work having overseen the development of affordable housing here in Denver. So I joined ShopWorks Architecture after being a part of the ownership team for Arroyo Village, which was 130 units of housing and a brand new homeless shelter built from the ground up. So I kind of have lived and breathed this work on kind of both ends of this. And I was really surprised.
Is Arroyo Village surrounded by parking, empty parking?
So yeah. So Arroyo Village, we actually were able to work with the city of Denver. We did some car sharing. We're literally at a light rail stop, and we gave all residents in the affordable housing RTD passes. So that actually has a pretty good level of parking. You know, and what we find too, so Arroyo Village has 1, 2, and 3 bedroom units. And so we also find for kind of family affordable housing, they kind of have a higher rate of car ownership. Sometimes that's because families have lived in their cars. And so that's kind of been the one thing they've held on to as they sought to kind of get their feet back on the ground.
Wow. So, and then I assume usage is going to be higher than 29% or 8.8% because of staff and visitors.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, this interesting conversation I think that we need to have. So for staff in a lot of affordable housing and specifically supportive housing, there's a high staff ratio, but those staff are actually working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so while you might look at the staff number and be like, oh my gosh, there's 10 staff people, we need 10 spots for them. That's actually not the case because only certain staff are there, kind of the 9 to 5, for example. Yeah. And so, yes, so I think this was focused, you know, and in our study, we didn't do parking lot counts. I literally worked with every property manager in every apartment building and asked them, you know, residents were required to register their car. And I asked every property manager how many people had a registered car. And you know, they needed to register to get access to the parking garage and things of that nature. And so to me, these are really true numbers. They're as honest as we can get in this work.
Yeah. So the difference between registered cars and the number of cars actually owned by occupants would be very small, right? Because like, if you don't have a registered car, you don't have a parking tag. You've got a ticket on your car.
Exactly. Yep. Your car's getting towed. Yep. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, did you study any Boulder properties for this? I think you did.
Yeah, we did. So we looked at Lee Hill specifically in Boulder that was a part of this study. You know, as we think about kind of parking, they provided 14 parking spots, but only 3 residents have cars.
Wow.
Okay. You know, and it's one of those things, you know, I walk these properties. I chatted with the residents of Lee Hill before. There's a Bluebird Boulder by Element Properties that is coming to town soon. It's currently under construction. And so we did research on Lee Hill, talking to residents and things of that nature about our trauma-informed design work, which I know we'll discuss later. But you know, that parking lot abuts like this beautiful green space, you know, and I just, whenever I see that parking lot, I'm like, wow, that green space could just be a little bit bigger, you know?
That's right. 11 parking spots is not a huge asphalt meadow like others that you see
at
shopping plazas. But I wonder, like, what are some of the worst offenders that you've seen in the Denver?
Yes.
I guess it wasn't just Denver and Boulder. It was, you went to Greeley and...
We went to, Colorado Springs. So I think the worst offender was one of the CCH, Colorado Coalition for the Homeless properties. They were required to build, I'm just trying to get the exact number, a little over 100 parking spots, and only 15 of those are used by residents. What we find in our parking study is that we built 883 parking spaces for 1,300 units across all 19 properties. Okay. And out of those, on average, 422 of those are currently are not used. They don't have residents who are parking there. They're not utilized by staff. And at an average of $22,000 per parking space, which we think is actually quite less than what it actually costs to build each parking space. That's
properties.
Yep. Just at those properties, $9.3 million of funds were spent on parking spaces that aren't utilized. And the funding for this affordable housing is our tax dollars, their state, you know, this is our money that is being used, and that could have built an entirely unique 40 unit affordable housing building, you know? And so I think for me, that's really the thing that feels devastating, that currently 40 people are currently unhoused who could be housed just in the savings on these parking.
Well, yeah. And it's not just the money savings, it's the space that you recoup for better use, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. It's more units, it's gardens, you know, which ties into our trauma-informed design work. But it's the things that really help us heal and find joy and dignity in our life, whether we're living in these buildings or not. Yeah. And instead we're building concrete that's just hot and bad for our environment and bad for our mental health. You know,
I'm so glad you have this data available, and I'm going to point, you know, some of our Boulder city policymakers towards it, because they're talking about, you know, reforming parking on the next work plan. And, this is just a really valuable resource. Thank you for doing that. When I heard you summarize this study earlier at the advisory board meeting, my first thought was like, oh, that space that could be used for more units, you know, that you could have reduced the space dedicated to parking and built a bigger complex. Mm-hmm. But after watching your trauma-informed design stuff, I was thinking, oh, yeah, you know, maybe some green space would be another possibility. So your notion of gardens are... I wonder for the existing parking, if there isn't... I mean, this sounds kind of cold and calculating, but if there isn't a revenue possibility at some of the properties to sell the parking, it seems like that would be better than just leaving it empty.
Yeah, I think... I think the problem is that the biggest issue in right-sizing parking is all the codes. You know, and Denver, you know, I will say I've been incredibly impressed with their community planning department, and they have actually shifted parking requirements here in Denver since this study was created. So there was a RTD study done at the same time that we did our study. You know, there are folks who live in Denver and they're walking our properties as well and seeing this empty parking. And so in Denver, we were actually able to shift parking down to 0.1 spaces per unit for 60% AMI and below. You know, so it's being mindful of kind of the results of this study, the RTD study, adding some flexibility for staff, but acknowledging, you know, this is something we need to fix. And the parking code in Denver hadn't been updated in over a decade. And when parking code was originally created, supportive housing wasn't even a thing that people that existed yet. It wasn't a best practice. It wasn't happening. So I really do commend the city of Denver for seeing this problem and realizing we need to live our values. If we believe affordable housing is critical, we need to be getting rid of these barriers, you know? And I think that's the big thing about parking is people are like, oh, wow, just building on parking you don't need, that's a problem. But actually the high level of parking requirements, because in Denver and some parts of the city, it was 1.25 spots per unit. And there was a little bit of an affordable housing, you could cut some of those, but still, you know, what that did is it adds this extra level of cost to these affordable housing developments. It makes them required to buy larger plots of land. Yeah. And that's the real problem is that parking, I'm super passionate about parking because the parking requirements stopped, I want to say at least a third of the projects we were looking at before they even hit the visioning stage. We'd look at the parking requirement. We'd look at trying to convince people that the parking wasn't necessary. It was too much risk for a process that's already tenuous.
It doesn't pencil out close enough to even like go from there. Yeah,
exactly. You know, and so I think for me, you know, I've become passionate about parking because I want people to be housed. I want everybody who lives to have safe and stable and dignified housing. And parking requirements are getting in the way, and they're unnecessary in many ways.
Well, I've often joked that there's only one thing worse than a full parking lot. I think you know the answer. It's an empty parking lot.
Exactly.
It's the worst, you know.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, that's great work. Thank you for tackling that. Do you have anything else you want to say about parking or can we move on?
I don't
on
think
to
so.
Yeah. Design? Yeah. So, yeah. I don't want to try to introduce it. Why don't you just go ahead and tee it up?
Sure. Yeah. Trauma-informed design, where to start? I'll try to not geek out too much. So I approached this work. I started my life as a community organizer. I was a program director, deputy director, and interim executive director at a homeless shelter while we were developing housing. And one of the things that is a best practice...
You used a lot of words to describe your role, except what you actually did there. So did you like live at supportive housing and you were like a staff member on site or you were?
Yeah. No. So I worked at the Dolores Project, which is a homeless shelter for women and trans folks across the gender spectrum. And while there, I held a number of roles. So I oversaw the homeless shelter from kind of the programs and services side. And then kind of throughout my time, I took higher levels of responsibility. And for my last bit of time there, I was the interim executive director while we were finishing up our housing development. And one of the things I know from kind of the services and program side is that trauma-informed care is a best practice. So this is evidence-based research about acknowledging that the vast majority of folks who are currently unhoused have experiences of trauma. It's a best practice. I mean, my kids go to Denver Public Schools. They have trauma-informed care advocates there as well. I think trauma is the public health crisis of our generation. And I think we're getting more and more awareness about this. But what we found when we were sitting with ShopWorks Architecture, right? I was a client of them at the time, was architects and designers are not taught about trauma. They have to think about fire life safety. They have to think about wall sections. Their jobs are impossibly hard, in my opinion. But the mental health of the people in the building was not a thought that architects are thought to think about. And so we brought the architects and interior designer on the development in for a trauma training, and it really blew their minds. And so we started kind of our conversations as a team over how should an acknowledgement that the vast majority of the staff and residents and shelter guests in this building will have high levels of trauma, and how should that impact the design? And we were doing research, and there wasn't a lot out there. We could find research on how to inform the design of a therapist's office based on trauma, but that feels really different than how to design somebody's home. And so back in 2016, we started just trying to think these thoughts on Arroyo Village as a development specifically. So that was a partnership with Rocky Mountain Communities, who does affordable housing, and the Dolores Project, who ran a homeless shelter and is now running supportive housing. And it's been such a journey as we think about it. I think the heart and soul of it is acknowledging when folks have experienced trauma, especially kids. Kids' brains are forming 1 million new neural connections every second. And when kids experience trauma, we see that trauma wears a groove in the developing brain, right? And so if kids experience trauma and adults, the average age of guests at the Dolores Project was 49 years old. But chronic states of trauma keep people in fight, flight, or freeze. And what we find is brains that are constantly in that fight, flight, or freeze, even once they leave the traumatic situation, they still, quote, overreact to triggers that are actually could be even safe. But their bodies overreact to the triggers and then underreact. The prefrontal cortex underreacts, which is the thing that puts on the brake and tells people they're safe. And so we see kind of even decades later, folks who have experiences of trauma are hypervigilant. They focus on threat-related cues. So wherever they go, I mean, we're all scanning our environment. Biophilia tells us we're constantly looking at where we're safe and where we're not. But folks who have higher levels of trauma and those experiences kind of look at that even higher, right? I have friends who are like, can you sit with your back to the door? Because I actually won't be able to eat our meal together if my back is to the door. And I'm like, okay, sure, right? But those are things I don't think about as much. Anyway, and so as we think about kind of trauma's impact on the brain and our bodies, we need to think about how buildings can help us heal and thrive.
When you were talking about scanning the environment, it reminded me of this word I learned watching the videos, thigmotaxis. I don't know if I'm saying it right. it was the word about response to touch stimulus.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anyways.
Yes. Well, and I think, you know, research on biophilia, you know, Rochelle Maker at Group 14 is a member of our research team. And she brings just this incredible level of expertise about biophilia. And the research, you know, she's so sweet, and she'll kind of drop these big moments just in this really gentle, calm voice. And she'd be like, well, you know, Laura, the reason you like flowers is that flowers are a signifier that fruit is coming, and your body loves flowers because it means sustenance. And I'm like, I just thought I liked lilies, you know? And, you know, she talks about, you know, whenever we walk into any space, you know, our kind of our histories upon histories upon histories, right? We learn trauma like lives in DNA now and can be passed on through generations. But also as a species, you know, we love booths and restaurants because out in the savannah, we would like put our backs against a rock and look out, right? We want opportunities for prospect and refuge. Yeah. And that's why I like that booth when I go to Denny's, you know? I mean, it's just, it's so funny because these things that just feel like, oh, but that's just what I like. And she's like, yeah. And they're like anthropology. And there are many things that are why you like that. And you're not that unique, you know? And so I think, you know, biophilia alongside trauma-informed care, are this huge foundation of our work because they are evidence-based, you know, and we've gotten recent grant funding from the SOZOSE Foundation and the Kaiser Permanente Foundation to develop that kind of same level of evidence-based research about trauma-informed design. But we're, you know, super early on in the process, and these other things have been studied for decades upon decades.
So when I think about architects and designers doing their work, I think about, you know, and especially like in an apartment complex, you know, multi-unit building, I imagine they obsess over details around efficiency and some aesthetics and, you know, how does it work functionally?
And so
the notion that trauma and informed care, a lens on that should affect how they arrange a unit or the of the entryway. How does the rubber hit the road there?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think, you know, we do have a trauma-informed design framework. So we came out with an original one in 2020, and then we created a second one. We just last in May 2023, we published our new framework. And so the key part of our trauma-informed design work is talking to the folks who are going to use the building. That I don't, you know, and which is,
this is a theme,
not
on
rocket
podcast.
Science.
This is a theme on the podcast. You ask people who are going to live there what they want.
What they want. And they're right. They know what they need. You know, and so we did this at the Dolores Project. I'm a community organizer by training, and we're designing a homeless shelter. And so I take the design of spaces to our guests. We had a guest advisory committee that met monthly, and I would ask them, what do you think is working here and what should we change? You know, and so for example, the one that really floored me, and really for me just kind of solidified the importance of that work was, in the old iteration of the shelter, the staff office was on the opposite side of the dorm. It was just an old retrofitted building. That's what we could do. We were thankful for the building. And so in the new iteration of the building, I put the staff office with glass doors across a hall from the dorm with glass doors. And I was pretty excited because I'm like, we are solving this problem that has constantly been an issue. If a guest is having an issue in the middle of the night, somebody has to run down the hallway, it's dark, it's scary, it doesn't feel good. And that the guest looked at me and said, that is not good enough, Laura. And the average age of guest is 49. So these are like, you know, older folks. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, we want the staff office inside the dorm. And for me, that is like, but I'm offering you dignity and privacy and respect. Like, why do you want staff looking over you? And they're like, because if staff are watching me while I sleep, I will rest for the first time in a decade, Laura. And here I was with my best of intentions, but if I had not been doing the process that we've now iterated as our trauma-informed design process, those guests would not rest. And it would be all my fault because I'm the one who made that decision with the best of intentions.
Yeah, because that notion of privacy is a very powerful intuition that
right.
People, especially people that have been traumatized, are gonna not going to want to be exposed.
Right.
That's an interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. But I imagine that that particular need or desire is kind of widely different for different people, right?
Exactly. Yep. And I think that that's the thing, you know, so the heart of our trauma-informed design work is we have our framework, which I might just pull up right now briefly. In the middle, we have the foundational idea of safety. Safety is absolutely critical for trauma-informed design. If I don't feel safe in a space, I'm never going to move on my path towards stability, towards healing. That's true for all of us as human beings, right? And I do want to take a second and say, The studies demonstrate that 67% of Americans have experiences of trauma, have what's called an ACE score, an adverse childhood experiences score. So when I'm talking about trauma-informed design, I am not talking about homeless shelters and just affordable housing. I am talking about schools and grocery stores and parks and how we're building our cities so people can thrive. And I do think it's really important. This isn't an us and them thing. This is an us thing. This is how are we designing buildings for people, right? My parking work is how are we designing cities and spaces for human beings, not cars. I understand humans drive cars, but like we got to prioritize our health, our mental health first. And so as we think about this TID framework, you know, then we have the three C's around it: connection, choice, and comfort. Connection, the way that we get through this life is together. It's critical to design spaces for connection. You know, we see this in things like making sure staff offices are in close proximity to amenity spaces. We made this mistake at the Dolores Apartments at Arroyo Village. The staff offices are on the first floor and this glorious amenity space is on the second floor, and nobody uses the second floor amenity space. They always sit in the four little chairs in the lobby, right? We as human beings in our hard moments, we want to be close to people, and that closeness might look different, right? And that's why the concept of choice is critical. Sometimes when people are having a hard moment, they want to go and they want to sit across from the staff desk and just like word vomit, right? I'm a word vomiter when I'm having a moment, right? I call a friend and I'm just like, can we go for a walk? And I just need to talk. Yeah. And through that talking, I figure things out. But other people, if they're having a hard moment, you know, I think of an individual who was at Laurel House, which is supportive housing for youth who are unhoused moving into housing. And one of the individuals there noted, when I'm having a hard moment, I leave my individual apartment because I know I'm not always safe to myself if I'm alone, but I don't want to talk to anybody. And so we created these little reading nooks. They're these little kind of circular cutouts with some soft pillows on just the outside walls of a bigger amenity space. And they said, sometimes they'll spend 8 hours there. Because they can see people.
Maybe like 18 inches into the cutout of the wall.
Yeah. So their full body can kind of snuggle up into that. They can be in the fetal position. They can be around other people, but they don't have to talk or engage with anybody else. And it's one of the ways they keep themselves safe, right? So choice, this is also about empowerment, right? We all like having choices. So dimmer switches, how do we do different furniture and different units? You know, what does that look like? And comfort. Comfort is kind of comfort and joy, but things that bring us at ease or spark joy in us. And then as we think about kind of those values that we need to design for, we also think about kind of buildings are a part of systems, right? So property management, services and programs that are offered in the building, and other external factors, right? We designed beautiful spaces and COVID shut a lot of those down. And that created feelings among residents over, yeah, there's this beautiful amenity space, but I don't get to use it, right? And that was to protect people's safety, but that felt hard, right? So this beautiful space, instead of helping people heal, was another triggering, like, oh, and I don't get nice things, right? And now those spaces are open and, you know, I'll be interested in some of those buildings to hear a couple years out, kind of has that identity shifted now that you can use those. And then as we think about our TID framework, there's this idea of know, learn, and commit. If we are designing housing for a population that is different than the identities that we share, and even if it is the same, because identities are, we all have different experiences. We need to make sure that we're taking time to get to know those individuals, to maybe unlearn some unhelpful things we might assume about those individuals, and commit to this work. So we have a four-phase process, which I'm happy to go into later. But a lot of this work is when I asked the guests at the shelter what they needed and they told me, I gave it to them as much as humanly possible, including personally fundraising hundreds of thousands of dollars to make beautiful things happen that weren't in the budget, right? That we need to trust that people know what they need. And if we are in a positions of power, we need to do everything in that power to make sure people access those things.
Awesome. Well, I do hope we get to the four steps of the of the TID, I forgot what you call it, engagement process, or because there's a few things I'm eager to talk about, especially that second step about pre-occupancy evaluation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Can we just launch into that?
Great. Perfect. Yes. So one of the things is we put out our initial framework in 2020, expecting, I was like, maybe 100 people will read this publication. That'll be great. We sit, 3 years after that? And we've had thousands of people engaged in our work, from groups like the DC Housing Authority, to medical experts in the UK, to universities, to folks building affordable housing, Corporation for Supportive Housing, Enterprise Community Partners. Our partnerships on this have just been phenomenal. And one of the things that the industry asked for once we put out our original framework was, okay, you got to make this plain. What does this look like, right? Of course, we want to design spaces that are safe, but how do we do that? And so we created a couple more publications. One is an architectural principles document, and then one was this trauma-informed design process. So all of these materials are available on our website, shopworksarc.com/TID. And hope you'll put that in the show notes.
Definitely will, yes.
There's so much more than I can share in this podcast. Yeah. And so what we really iterated on through over 40 trauma-informed design processes on different projects was this process. How do we do this? How do we live into this? So first we set a vision, we do trainings, we think about that know, learn, commit. We say, who's this development for? What learning do we need to do? That's phase one. And then phase two is really the meat of our work, pre-occupancy evaluation. And so we take time on every project at the beginning, and we go and we talk to staff, property management, and potential residents of buildings or kind of utilizers of shelters about what they need and want. Tell me how you experience, where do you feel safe? Where do you make connections to staff? Where do you make connections to fellow residents? And we put together reports, and I'm happy to share sample reports with folks if they want them. Again, all of this is open source. The goal is that our work helps others do this work and that we learn things from you when you start diving into it. Well, and that's really the key. And that's where we learn those questions of, you know, you ask, where does the rubber meet the road? That's where I learn, this is what safety feels like to this population, right? So things are different across gender lines, across identities, across races, across neighborhoods. And so we need to make sure that we're not just assuming what safety feels like for people, but we're asking them what is safe and then trying to kind of copy some of those deep ideas into the design of these buildings.
It's so funny because even as I asked you the question about the rubber hits the road, the answer I was wanting was like, oh, you just rearrange things like this.
So it looks like this,
you know.
No.
And, you know, so you can kind of put a drawing up that says, like, here's how you would change an apartment to make it safe for this population or you know, ideal. And you're just relentless about coming back to the fact that you have to listen to people and get their input. And this really resonates with me in kind of two dimensions. One is I'm a software guy. And if you go off and build software without understanding the users that are going to be solving problems with this, you are you're solving the wrong problem. I mean, that's just like a basic understanding of software development. You cannot go build software without understanding the workflow of the people you're building it for. So there's a very nice parallel there.
Yep.
Boulder's Politics, one of the events that sort of kicks off the campaign season for city council, which is in odd years. So we've just launched a new odd year, city council campaign season there's an event called the Raucous Caucus. And one of the questions they asked, I think they asked just a few of the candidates was, what is the most underrepresented population in Boulder?
Mm.
And the answer, I was like, oh, I want to answer this, you know, because for me, the answer is the people who don't live here yet, who would, you know, future residents are often the most unheard, unlistened to. You know, they're not part of the political process. And there's just, you know, just like thinking about the political landscape of housing. There's kind of two things that are always working against housing. One is just change versus not changing. It's so easy to not change. And the rules, rules are kind of set up to impede fast change, right? But the other is like the incumbents versus the newcomers. And the newcomers don't know who they are frequently. And they're not there to say, hey, I'd like to, you know, like, because the, all the incumbents know who they are and they can show up and protest a new building. And much less, you know, think about, you know, this whole phase two of pre-occupancy evaluation where you actually invite the newcomers in and say, what do you want built here? I mean, like, we don't even get to that. It's more like, will we build, will we allow anything to be built here at all? So I just like, it just, to me, it just sort of flips the whole script of who are we building this for and who gets affected. And in the political realm, it's always about who's negatively impacted by some new housing rather than like the visionary, how can we make this as beautiful as possible for the people that are going to use it? Sorry. I went to my rant. Sorry. Well,
I mean, and I think that's, I mean, I think one of my, we do a lot of community engagement at ShopWorks, and I respect, you know, I mean, I once presented to my daughter's fourth grade classroom on affordable housing because we renovated an old 1900s, well, pre-1900s church in the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Denver. And their teacher knew this because Harper talks about the work that her mom does. And my husband's also in affordable housing. So the work we do as a family and what we're committed to, and spent our early days volunteering at a homeless shelter, you know, like, and the teacher was like, oh, can you come and talk about affordable housing? And then we'll walk, and they made blankets for the residents, which was really sweet. And you know, I had a fourth grader sitting there telling me, well, all affordable housing is ugly, you know? And I'm like, oh man, you know, and luckily I had pictures of ShopWorks projects. I think other architects designed beautiful buildings as well. And I said, well, do you think this is affordable housing? He's like, no, that's beautiful. And I'm like, it is, right? Anyway, so as I think about our community engagement, for me, it's like, I know I tried to not shame a fourth grader. I really tried to be the bigger person in the room, you know, but I do think, you know, I think we're all, I hate change. Like, change terrifies me, you know, but I do think there's all these misconceptions. But, you know, to me, the hard line I have is, if you are somebody who has housing and you're getting in the way of other people's having housing, that to me is the issue. Because I, you know, people fight affordable housing on, oh, there's not enough parking, or there's not enough this. And I struggle because I'm just like, but we all deserve housing. And it might feel inconvenient, but you still have your house, you know? And isn't that the world we want to create? You know, and I do think, you know, some of the old affordable housing, the 1950s, does us a complete disservice, because that stuff was ugly, right? And that's what people think, too.
Ugly is almost charitable, because it was...
Yeah, fair.
It was
detrimental,
so,
harmful.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, but I do think,
phase one and phase two.
Perfect. Yeah. And so phase three is what I call the magic process. We're working on codifying it. But this is where we take the trauma-informed design report, all of these conversations, and then we try to put it into the building design. And ideally, like we did on Bluebird Boulder, we do the phase two pre-occupancy evaluation report, present it to the team. The architects go, and I'll sit there with the architects as we design spaces, and they'll be like, what do you think about this? And I'll be like, well, can we meet this need that was named? And then we took the like draft plans to the residents at Lee Hill, and we asked them, what do you think about this design, right? This is what we heard from you. This is what we put into the design. What are the thoughts? And they shared reflections and, you know, positives and negatives, and really helped kind of refine that design, right? No design will be perfect, but we can get to as good as possible, right? Given all of the constraints. And then phase four looks a lot like phase two, but we just go back into the building and we ask folks, you know, we ask them big questions like, how does this building make you feel? You know, And then nitty gritty, like, do you like your bathroom and do you like your shower or tub or do you like your faucet? And then we put together post-occupancy evaluations, which our team commits to on every project. And we then have the really hard job of telling the architects where they made mistakes. And the architects at ShopWorks are like, the compliments are fine, but we want to know that because then we can fix it on the next building, right? And then we try to share that information over, you know, what's helpful and what's not. And so I think, you know, this process takes some time. Phase two takes some time at the beginning of projects before they're usually funded. But generally, what we find when we implement this process is that we, there's this thing called the McLeany curve, which really acknowledges the deeper design work you can do at the beginning in pre-design and schematic design of a project, then you can actually create and end up with the building that you want. But often due to kind of funding constraints and just these affordable housing developments especially are just hard to design, the timelines are tight, the funding is scarce. People end up trying to make design decisions later on in the project when you can't always impact the project as much because you already have your footprint or major decisions made, and it costs a heck of a lot more to make those changes. And so what we find in our trauma-informed design work, people are always like, well, this is nice, but affordable housing budgets are hard enough already and you're adding something to it, Laura. And I'm like, no, no, no. What we're doing is we're identifying high-level values. We're getting the entire team, nonprofit directors, program providers, property managers, developers, architects, engineers, contractors on the same page. And yes, you invest more time up front, but you save that time throughout the rest of the process. You know, I saw this at a Royal Village. There were certain things I asked for that cost significant amounts of money, and Blue Line Development was the developer on it. And I understood we were working in a limited budget, but whenever I put my foot down and I said, this is an absolute must on this development, we have to figure out how to make it work, they found the money, right? Or I agreed to fundraise some of it, right? And so I do think that trauma-informed design, it's like dimmer switches on lights. That does not cost, that is a drop in the bucket of a construction budget, but having residents have the ability, depending on, you know, some folks who have trauma have chronic migraines, and them being able to dim their lights and not have them completely off is a complete and utter game changer, right? And so it's thinking about these things early on and putting them into the budget early on. And then it just makes it easier in the long run.
It's amazing that you pulled it off, because you're clearly adding extra expense that, you know, some manager somewhere who's like penciling all this out is thinking, oh, we don't want this extra expense at the beginning of the project before the LIHTC funding even comes through, right, or whatever.
Yeah,
so that's a pretty good chicken and egg thing that you figured out how to hatch. So congratulations.
Yeah.
Such a cool framework and change making, you know, approach to housing. It's just amazing. So
thanks.
I had a quick question. Is the Bluebird property going to have too much parking?
No, it will not. That is such a good question. Let me just pull up that. So, supportive housing in Boulder is a little complicated, but we ended up with 40 bedrooms and 8 parking spots, which we feel really good about. So supportive housing in Boulder has a really kind of specific place in the code. It can be categorized as residential care versus just kind of straight up affordable housing.
Like a group home kind of.
Yep. Yep. Even though it's just, I mean, it's just apartment homes, like, but we'll use that because it really does help the parking. And so, you know, I think we were careful. So we did 0.2 parking spots per unit as our ratio. We think that's a little high, but you know, we wanted to be mindful. And I think that's the thing about, you know, even the parking matters, is a developer is not going to create a building without enough parking for the residents, because they have to lease it up, you know? And so I think, you know, one of the things that we're seeing across the country as it relates to parking is parking maximums as opposed to minimums, you know, and Denver did a, you know, really low parking minimum, right? But let's think about the world we want to create, like biking and walking and places for people to thrive. And let's make sure the code is not creating barriers to creating those visions and goals that I know we all have. And I think the parking maximum versus the parking minimum, I think that's where the industry is going. You know, even just in the month of May, like the cover of CNN.com was about parking in housing. There's two books that came out, you know, like there's a whole thing on The Atlantic with the title, How Parking Destroys Cities. Yep. And I do think this is a conversation we're really starting to have in a bigger way. And I feel really hopeful. Because I want cities and buildings and spaces to be designed for my kids to play and me to experience joy. And concrete makes us all feel more stressful, whether we acknowledge it or not.
Amen. Amen. Well, I thank you so much for sharing with us today. I know you have a meeting coming up in 90 seconds.
Yeah.
So I want to be respectful of your time. This has really just lit up my imagination. And we could have gone another hour, I'm sure.
I know. It's the problem.
Thank you
I geek
so
out
much
over
for
it.
Sharing.
Gonna find me a residential pedestrian district where I can gracefully grow older. Gonna spend my remaining years sharing Boulder.
Thank you for listening to Sharing Boulder. Please support the podcast by sharing it with your friends and neighbors. You can contact me at linktree.com/Philip Ogren, which you can find by DuckDuckGoing, Linktree Philip Ogren, or by visiting sharingboulder.us, where you can also find show notes and previous episodes. This episode of Sharing Boulder was produced by Philip Ogren, and the music was created by Nathaniel Ogren and Sack Lunch. Keep sharing Boulder!